Welcome to the Nutrition Edit Podcast for high-performing women who want to up-level their health and feel their best in their bodies, careers, and personal lives. In this podcast, I'll sift through the latest nutrition and biohacking trends to filter out the bullshit, share what you really need to know, and help you put the good stuff into practice in a way that works for you. You'll get actionable tips from guest experts and myself on how to up-level your mindset, workouts, relationships, and environment, and start feeling like the badass woman you are. Join me as we bust through the bro science and male-centric health paradigm to help you achieve optimal performance, body, mind, and soul. Hey, Dr. Larry, welcome back to the Nutrition Edit. I'm so glad you joined us again.
Thanks, Jeannie. Happy to be here.
Yeah, thanks for taking the time. So for those who have maybe not heard you on a previous episode, just give us a little introduction to who you are and what you do.
Yeah, I am first and foremost, I wanted to share with your audience, I apologize for my voice. It's a little raspy. I am getting over an upper respiratory infection. I have a five-year-old who's a little petri dish, which I know a lot of your listeners have kids. So please accept my apologies ahead of time if I have to deviate from talking and take a sip of tea. My background is as a certified functional medicine practitioner. I was trained as a naturopathic physician and did a two-year residency in primary care, adult family medicine. I then had a particular interest in neurology, and I did a fellowship through the society, national chapter of the MS Society at University of Washington, Virginia Mason, and Swedish here in Seattle, where I practice. I currently am the director of Vita Integrated Health, a integrated health clinic here in Seattle. We have six locations as of recently, and I have a blog called Power Sex Beauty, which I talk about things related to sexual health, women's health, and attachment theory, which you and I had a great conversation with.
Yeah, it's fascinating.
Yeah. So happy to be here.
Awesome. Yeah, welcome. So today we're going to dive into longevity medicine. So just give us a little bit about a definition about that. We hear often the term anti-aging. We look for anti-aging skincare, anti-aging supplements, whatever that might be. But the reality is that we cannot fight time. We're all aging, right? Mm-hmm. So when I think of longevity medicine, I think of how can we age in the best way possible? Like, how can we feel our best at every stage of life? Yeah. So just define longevity medicine for us and your philosophy.
Yeah. So longevity medicine has really taken the functional medicine community and those who have a higher level of health interest and health education by storm. Kind of everybody knows this term over the last couple of years. I think a big thank you is owed to people like Dr. Peter Attia, who's really leading the charge on trying to educate the masses. Longevity medicine to me is really about the health span. So we hear a lot about the lifespan and how that is a chronological process. We, as you said, can't slow down our chronological age. You and I are older now than when we started talking a few minutes ago, but we potentially could get healthier than where we are right now. And that is really what longevity medicine is about and how we can improve our quality of life and even our biological age, which is a little bit of a controversial topic. There's a lot of different ways that people say they can measure biological age. There are online calculators, even. There are different types of laboratory values. There are certain genes that can be influenced, turned on and off. But in any case, longevity medicine encompasses the idea that we can help improve or slow down the aging of our biological age, even though we cannot do anything in regards to our chronological age and improve our health span and the number of healthy years that we can live throughout our life.
Awesome. I love that term, health span. Mm-hmm. I did have Bruce Barry, local kind of water sports legend, on in season one, I think it was. Yeah. Talking about this. He's 73 now, I believe, and still like just killing it out there. Yeah. And yeah, he uses that term a lot, health span, which I think is really cool. Really
it's cool. Huge. It's just, that's what we would all aspire to. I think it's just it's an uphill battle, frankly, as we get older. We can compensate a bit. Our bodies will compensate when we're younger because those repair mechanisms are far more robust. Mm. They are far more dialed in and forgiving. My 5-year-old son, if he gets injured or something like that, the likelihood that he's going to recover, fortunately, is far faster and far better than I probably would, given the same extent of the injury. And that's by design, is that nature wants us to survive, to reproduce. And then once we're past an age of reproduction, and this is particularly important for women, is that we really do start to see a decline if we don't work harder in our environment, in our life style, behaviors, and what our inputs are nutritionally being one example. We can really see that acceleration of aging can take off after that reproductive period is no longer applicable.
Absolutely. And the majority of the women who I see in my practice and are my age, maybe a little younger or a little older, but having just turned 50, obviously really relevant to me as well. And I hear so often, my body just doesn't respond the way it used to. Everything takes longer. It's so much harder. And I think people assume, oh, my metabolism is just slowing down. It's yes, things are slowing down, but speak into how our hormones play a role in this and what shifts are actually happening, especially during those perimenopause and then menopausal years that look so different from maybe when we're in our early 40s or prior.
I know you have a pretty health educated audience on your podcast, but I'm going to just make it really simplified here for a moment. And then I'd like to go into this in a more in-depth way, because I think it's a much more complex answer and question about how women, particularly in the brain health arena, and as our bodies get older, how we age differently than men. Just to recap, menopause is defined as is not having a menstrual cycle for 1 year. And that is not secondary to another condition like PCOS or something. It's actually when our ovaries are no longer producing the amount of estrogen that our brain then notices. It starts to rise a hormone called FSH. And then we can see that on laboratory values that we can see, okay, not only is this woman not having a menstrual cycle, but she also has an elevation in this pituitary hormone called FSH. And when someone is postmenopausal, it's really defined as she has a significantly lower level of circulating estrogen typically than what, or always, unless she's on hormones, than she would have had when cycling. There are three different types of estrogens that our body has, estradiol being the most prominent, which is what the ovaries are producing when we're regularly menstruating through menarche, or when we first get our menstrual cycle as teenagers, and all the way through menopause. So estradiol is the big one, and it actually has the strongest effects on all of our body's tissue. And relevant to today's conversation, very important for the brain. The other two types of estrogen are something called estrone and estriol. Estrone can be produced by our fat tissue. So it's really important to note that women who have more fat tissue, adipose tissue, do tend to have higher levels of estrone, circulating estrone, and some of that can be converted into estradiol. So if you measure estradiol in a postmenopausal woman and it's a little bit higher, it doesn't mean that her ovaries have turned back on. It does mean that there's probably some conversion going on from the fat tissue. And then third is called estriol, which is highest produced in women when they are pregnant. It's produced from the placenta. However, when we are not pregnant, then it can also be converted from estradiol. So there is an interconversion there. Important to know the lay of the land. And then progesterone is only produced post-ovulatory. So if a woman is no longer ovulating, which only happens during regular menstrual cycles or a menstrual cycle prior to menopause, then we are no longer getting progesterone circulating in an abundant amount, again, if she is not on hormone replacement therapy. I just want to be clear on what menopause is.
Yeah, that's helpful.
Perimenopause is the period when cycles start to become a little erratic. There can be symptoms involved in that time period, as there can be postmenopausally. And that is when some women will start to notice a change in how they feel from a overall kind of health perspective, barring no other significant health changes. They may notice a decline in their sleep quality. They may notice a significant decline in their ability to regulate their mood, a drop in libido, as I believe you and I have previously talked about. And they may also notice a change in their cognition. And this can be really alarming for a lot of women who especially are mid-career or have prominent responsibilities in their life, really for anyone who our brains are who we are, right? Yeah. And so if you start to lose a little bit of that and you don't have a great explanation, you can really start to question, like, oh my gosh, is I feel like this now. When am I going to feel like
it? Exactly. Yeah.
Scary. The relationship between estrogen, if I'm going to oversimplify it here, progesterone has a very significant role, but for today's purposes, estrogen and longevity is multifactorial. I often will tell women it impacts your bones in a robust way, can stimulate bone growth, maintain our bone density. It impacts our cardiovascular health. We can actually see an uptick in cholesterol values and an increased risk of cardiovascular disease postmenopausally. There is a relationship there, even though estrogen has its own set of risks when you administer it outside the body. And then the brain is extremely sensitive to changes in estrogen. And if there is a drop off, which inevitably there is a drop off, you will notice, most women will notice a change, as we just said, in cognition. And there are ways that we can mitigate that. And there are ways that we can support that. And it's not just with hormone replacement therapy.
That's a great, it's a great point, because I think that hormone replacement therapy has come a long way. It's drastically different. We talked about this a little bit in your first episode where you joined me, but it has a bad rap still. There's still that stigma around it and that sort of negative idea about HRT and estrogens because of the way it was initially, but it has changed a lot. And I think that it's really great and encouraging for people to know that there are alternatives to that, because it's not for everybody, I would think, just like nothing's for every single person all the time.
Correct.
And so if hormone replacement therapy is not for you, it's good to know that there are alternatives. And I'm thinking basic things like nutrition, exercise, how we use those can make a drastic difference. I know it has for me, especially cognitively.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's a really good point. It's just it isn't for everyone, Jeannie, as you said, and there are considerations. But I like to remind people not to diminish breast cancer risk. Breast cancer risk is something that we should all be aware of. And I absolutely advocate for regular screenings. And if somebody has a family history, to potentially find out your genetic risk. But I want to just remind everyone that cardiovascular disease is still the number one killer by far compared to breast cancer. And Alzheimer's disease is in fact more prevalent than breast cancer is in terms of the amount of women that it affects, although affects it's women disturbing. Typically older. And so I think that there is this kind of disregard in some ways that it's just the way it is when you're older. And I really hope that we can challenge that perception or that acceptance, because our population is aging and at a rapid rate because of the amount of people who are living longer. And we are going to have a massive pandemic of cognitive decline and Alzheimer's disease if we don't change some of these lifestyle behaviors that are existing right now.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. It's staggering, especially within my age group of our parents, like how many of our parents are dealing with this. And remembering our grandparents, like very few of them, I feel, had these issues. And now it almost seems more common than not. And I have many clients who this is a genuine concern for them. I have close friends who have both gene alleles for this, and they've lost parents to Alzheimer's, and it's really frightening mm-hmm. for them. And but the flip side of that is now we also know a lot more and we can be empowered to make lifestyle and diet changes in order to give ourselves the best outcome or chances, right? It's not necessarily the predisposition isn't necessarily predetermination, right?
Yeah, that's correct. And you alluded to the Alzheimer's risk gene. You mentioned alleles. And just again, for your audience, I want to define that a little bit. So a allele is essentially a copy of a gene or a specific variant of a gene. And ApoE is the most common known contributing risk factor to mm-hmm. Alzheimer's disease. And it's very easy to test for. It's tested even through most genetic screenings. 23andMe does it and many other private companies. You can also get it from a standard lab company like LabCorp or Quest. I think it's very empowering to know. I think it's fair that people want to, they don't want to know always, but I think right. it's empowering once you do know. I think it's really important for people to understand that there are also Mendelian inherited genes that can then lead to a deterministic diagnosis of Alzheimer's disease. And what that means is that if you have this very rare, one of three rare genes, mm-hmm. and those are called gene APP, PSEN, or PSEN2. Those are three genes. They're not common in the population and usually are associated with very early onset Alzheimer's. So if somebody had a family history of a parent getting Alzheimer's disease at age 50 mm-hmm. and that parent had not been tested, it's well worth getting tested, as there are things you can do to slow down the progression. But that is not the vast majority of individuals who get Alzheimer's disease. In fact, out of Alzheimer's disease, that encompasses less than 5%. And that's a generous estimation.
Okay.
95% of Alzheimer's disease is influenced in some way, shape, or form by lifestyle behaviors, or any case of Alzheimer's disease is influenced by lifestyle behaviors. APO is a significant factor, more so for women than for men. And if you'd like me to, I can define that a little bit more and go into that.
Yeah, please do. Because like you say, it's more common for women than for men. And the more that we learn about it, I think the better. So this is all still relatively new information. So yeah, I think this is great info to share.
Yeah, unfortunately, there's just stuff coming out in the literature just in abundance right now. Everyone has two copies of an APOE gene. You get one from your dad and one from your mom. There's no ifs, ands, or buts about it. You get mm-hmm. one copy. APOE comes in three different flavors or varieties. Okay. There's APOE2, APOE3, and APOE4. APOE2 is protective against Alzheimer's disease. So if you have, and it's also the rarest form, but it is protective if you have it. APOE3 is what we consider the normal type or the average risk. And then APOE4 is considered the high risk.
Okay.
You can have any combination thereof. So if your parents are both APOE3, so they got a three copy from their parent and grandparent, et cetera, and you get then two copies of APOE3, you know definitively you have an average risk from a genetic perspective. There's lots of influences lifestyle-wise, but you have an average risk. If you inherit one copy of the APOE4 mm-hmm. and you are a woman, it actually puts you in the same risk category. And this is debatable, but again, according to the literature, which I'll provide your listeners with these literature citations, you're in the same risk category as an APOE4/4 man. Seems to be a strong association in the drop-off in estrogen that women no longer receive after menopause and how that can influence their trajectory towards or away from Alzheimer's disease and dementia.
Yeah.
So when somebody is asking about their Alzheimer's risk or do I have the Alzheimer's gene in my practice, I will also want to understand what their metabolic risk is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And those are really critical things to understand because APOE4 is a pro-inflammatory gene.
Right.
And it was, I find this particularly fascinating, and I hope you do too, Jeannie.
You know I will. I'm a nerd about this stuff.
Yeah. You and I always nerd out on these conversations. Our ancestors, 200,000 years ago, when we were first coming down from the trees from our primate ancestors, we would have benefited from having an APOE4. And because it's pro-inflammatory, if we step on a sharp rock and we cut ourselves and we risk the infection,
yeah,
then APOE4 is very robustly pro-inflammatory and can be protective. There has been even some question whether APOE4 individuals are more protected against COVID in recent years. I don't know the conclusions of that study, but I know it is brought up in some circles. And APOE2, conversely, is a more recent, when I say recent, it showed up in the human population about 90,000 years ago. Okay. So our ancestors, 90,000 years ago versus 200,000 years ago is really when APOE4. So that's all to be said that when somebody has this APOE4, they may say, oh, there's no, why do I have this? Or why would, you know, nature for something that has a negative benefit or a negative result, why would we even have this? And the answer is because it's actually protective when we're exposed to something. How this furthermore influences the brain is that it also impacts cardiovascular risk and the removal of cholesterol from circulation. So it's able to then go essentially be expressed from our neurons. And then if we are unable to clear some of the cholesterol that is then circulating, it's actually produced predominantly in the astrocytes. Cholesterol gets aggregated in the astrocyte, which is a type of brain cell. That cholesterol is unable to be removed and it basically can bog up the whole system and lead to a slowing and degradation ultimately over time of brain function due to the production of something called amyloid beta.
Okay. And this is the plaques that are referred to. Okay.
Yep. Amyloid beta is a response to inflammation. When our brains do not detect a toxin, insulin resistance, inflammatory stimulus, fight or flight response to some extent, if there's nothing to worry about, then amyloid beta is not produced in the same amounts as it is when there's something to be on guard, which again, evolutionarily was beneficial. If there was a microbe that got into our brain, meningitis, something, then there was a more robust immune response and actually had a survival benefit.
Fascinating.
That no longer is relevant. For individuals with APOE4, they do tend to have this more pro-inflammatory response that's faster, and they are also slower to clear things like cholesterol from circulation, and it can impact the brain.
Yeah.
You can go the other direction, meaning the precursor to amyloid beta, which is aptly named as amyloid precursor protein, APP.
Okay.
You can actually push it towards what's called the alpha pathway. And that can be influenced by estrogen. So this is why I'm making a long road around, circling around. Women who have this protection, this amount of estrogen that they have, let's say, until age 50, just on average, they then suddenly have this abrupt drop-off. And we know that estrogen also helps to support insulin sensitivity.
Right.
So we no longer have that insulin sensitivity that we did prior to menopause. And we don't have this protective mechanism of estrogen then moving in to the amyloid precursor protein and influencing it to go to the alpha direction. Yeah. Instead, it goes towards the beta direction, which again, amyloid beta is what is pro-inflammatory and can over time aggregate and contribute to the development of Alzheimer's disease.
Okay. Yeah, that makes sense.
The last thing I'll say on this piece, I want to just mention Alzheimer's disease does start 25 years before diagnosis typically.
Hello, nutrition editors. If you've been listening and you're ready to put this work into practice in your own life, head over to joliverwellness.com and book a free 30-minute chat to learn more about coaching with me or to check out my self-study programs. I also invite you to join my email list where you'll hear from me a few times each month with recipes and strategies for reducing stress, improving your metabolic health, and working out smarter, not harder. Subscribers will also receive exclusive offers on my programs that I don't share anywhere else, and you'll get early access to registration for my Body Liberation Together group program. I look forward to connecting with you, and let's get back to the show. And I've heard that, and it feels really depressing to hear that because I am one of those women who has one allele of the APOE4 and has always had higher cholesterol levels in spite of the fact that my diet's pretty great. I move my body a lot. I technically do most of the right things. Right. So, yeah. So talk more about that, because if I'm 50, hopefully I live till what, 80 plus something years. Yeah. But if this is starting in most people 20, 25 years prior, what does that mean?
Yeah. It means that what you do now has a big impact in what is going to happen 25, 35 years from now. It has a significant impact. And what you have been doing over the last 10 years has a big impact, and even prior to that. And the really important piece, I think, about when somebody has an APOE4, I actually think it can be incredibly motivating to then be identifying areas of opportunity that they wouldn't otherwise pay attention to.
Yeah, I agree with that.
And they also may actually treat their body in a way that is more protective than somebody who thinks that they don't need to, right? Mm-hmm. So someone who has an APOE2 allele may say, I'm covered. And that's not true either, right? There's people who have APOE2 and they do get Alzheimer's disease. It's just statistically less likely. So I say to individuals like yourself that this influence, while it is significant, you have a baseline risk, and this is true for men as well, about 9% if you have the APO33. You have about this is lifetime risk, by the way. You have about a 30% risk if you have the APO34. And then you have over 50% lifetime risk if you have the 44. And again, that has not been stratified for gender differences, which they're trying to do. Just to make sure your audience is aware of that. But we know that what women do in terms of consideration of estrogen replacement, the right form of estrogen replacement, the amount of estrogen replacement, and if that individual, and this is what's so fascinating for me as a doctor, gets estrogen replacement around the time of menopause, perimenopause, as opposed to waiting 5 or 10 years, or getting the information at age 60 that they have the APOE34, and they say, "Oh, I want to start on estrogen now." It seems that protective benefit is less. It's not zero, but it's less. And more importantly, is the metabolic status of the individual at the time of estrogen initiation, as those with type 2 diabetes, this is a study I was reading in preparation for our conversation, those with type 2 diabetes who were put on hormone replacement therapy, who were also APOE4, actually ended up performing worse on cognitive assessment tests. It wasn't a long enough study to see whether Alzheimer's disease was developed, but they did do cognitive performance tests. and those individuals performed worse, they also didn't feel or respond as positively to hormones, suggesting that if someone is not metabolically in a place that estrogen's highly metabolic, it influences right. insulin, influences estrogen. There's so much crosstalk there. You're not in a good place for that metabolically. Perhaps that's where the priority needs to start before we think about hormones. But timing is also a factor. So it's a clinical conversation between doctor and patient.
Yeah, and that makes so much sense because if our insulin sensitivity is decreasing around this time in life, and we're still trying to eat in the way that we did previously, maybe higher carb, higher glycemic foods, we're still doing sugar, we're still doing alcohol, we very easily tend to look at, oh, I just gain weight more easily and focus on that piece of it.
Right.
And I often see clients of mine, they get impatient if they don't see something change on the scale right away when we're addressing metabolic health. But we're addressing metabolic health. So really, I'm starting from the place of let's get your blood sugar regulated. Let's help you become more insulin sensitive again. Let's help you move your body in a way that makes you more insulin sensitive. Let's increase your muscle mass or at least preserve it. And they'll say things like, my sleep's better, my energy's better, but I'm not losing weight. I'm still not getting results. But those things are so crucial. Those things are such crucial pieces, and they are indicators that it is helping, it is making a difference. And yeah. 10, 20 years down the road, are you going to care that much about the extra 10 or 15 pounds if you feel like you're losing your cognitive health? Probably, like, you're going to care more that you haven't lost your mind. That's a crude way of putting it, but it's I don't think that focusing on just the weight piece, I think that's a real mistake. I think that we need to have a longer term view and know, okay, oftentimes the fat loss will come in the picture. It'll come into play. It'll fall into line.
Yeah.
If we're taking care of our health on a cellular level, right? Looking at it from a metabolic health standpoint and creating more insulin sensitivity or preserving that versus just trying to do whatever we've done all the time, eating the same way, not changing that. Living in chronic stress, not prioritizing sleep, all of those things that it's, I just think it's really exciting to know this because we can take a different approach and prioritize these aspects of our health that are so much more crucial.
And I think that's why, like, the whole weight conversation, I think DEXA scans have really come into the picture. And I'm not sure if you've talked about that on previous episodes, but DEXA scans are using a type of X-ray technology to look at the different types of body composition. Originally, they were made for bone density analysis, and now they are being applied to looking at not only bone density, but also lean muscle tissue and fat mass in a much more accurate way than a handheld device or a smart scale, although they're not terrible, right? And so I think it's really important that in those DEXA scans, this is one of the things we do with all of our patients or as many patients who are willing to do it, is it measures something called visceral adiposity. Mm-hmm. And visceral adiposity is the fat around your organs. And as opposed to subcutaneous fat, which is the fat that most of us notice when we gain some weight or our pants don't fit as well, we'll notice, oh, and that is your subcutaneous fat. And visceral adiposity has a far greater influence on our metabolic profile, hence why I think labs in our practice is we're pretty lab heavy, admittedly. Yeah. I use them a lot, but I also think they can be incredibly motivating for clients and patients like you just discussed, that she's not losing weight, she's feeling frustrated, she's doing all the right things, but if you show her your insulin went from 14 to 7 and your fasting glucose was 95 and now your fasting glucose is 70 and your CGM is reading an average of 10 points lower and your leptin sensitivity is better and there's a variety of metrics that we can demonstrate. And, by the way, your lean tissue was able to maintain and your fat mass went down. Yeah, the scale stayed the same. All of those things go in. They get it, right? But if you're just looking at the scale and you're just looking at one metric.
It's not good data.
Yes. To the Nutrition Edit listeners here, it is a terrible metric. Yeah. It's just a terrible metric. Don't use it.
On BMI, I just, no. Not helpful.
Yeah, which whole conversation about why are we using the weight, the scale for even GLP-1 monitoring and all of this craze, but that's a whole different conversation.
Yeah, so. I try and get clients as often as they're willing to do DEXAs as well. And I include them with my group program too. So they have a follow-up one that they can go do as well and see what's shifting for them, because it is so much more helpful what's making a shift. And I don't care if the scale doesn't change, if your lean mass is increasing and your body fat's coming down and all of those numbers are improving. That's what we want to see.
And I do tell people it will shift, like the subcutaneous fat. If we are seeing a trend in the other directions, your body's just prioritizing what it knows is best for its overall health and survival. Mm-hmm. It's not going to prioritize what you look like in a swimsuit. That is not exactly what it's going to prioritize.
It's not going to ensure your survival.
Yeah. Yes. As much as most of us would like it to go there.
We'd love that, wouldn't we? Yeah. No,
I don't. I empathize with my patients when they're frustrated. But I do think it's important. And the relevance of lean tissue to overall longevity is just not debatable, how important it is for bone health, caloric expenditure on a day-to-day basis, mm-hmm. meaning our lean tissue burns so many more calories than
highly metabolically
active, mitochondrial density, and the importance of insulin sensitivity, as we just talked about. Muscle is a very insulin sensitive tissue, and you have more of it.
More is better.
Exercise, lean strength training, there is no other better form of exercise to improve your metabolic fitness. So cardiovascular is important too.
Yes, absolutely. I want to come back to that, but let's back up for just a second, because I'm a huge proponent of weight training. So I want to talk about some of the other benefits of that, which are massive. But touch really quick, Dr. Larry, on the difference between our genetics and our genetic expression. So we talked a little bit about epigenetics in my last episode, but I think this is a really important thing to reiterate for people or clarify for people, that genetic predisposition or what alleles you have, things like this, that's one piece. But when you were talking before about these lifestyle or, you know, dietary things that can influence, that's really talking about how can we influence our gene expression. So just talk a little bit about what that actually means and what those elements are that could potentially have a positive influence for someone like me, or maybe someone that has even a higher risk for one of these things.
Yeah. The conversation around epigenetics is, again, a hot topic. It has been at least for the last decade. And what it is, when we all come with a book of life, our genes are written in our chromosomes. And that is what we inherit from our parents, as we already talked about. However, those genes, whether they get turned on or turned off, can be influenced by things like food and exercise and the amount of exposure to pesticides, as an example, or mold exposure in our home, whether we are taking hormones or not, et cetera, et cetera. And the influence of those genes then essentially they make a protein in our body. And that protein can then be beneficial for certain things, or it can be of detriment to us.
Right.
An example is actually APOE4, since we're talking about it. A inflammatory or insulin-resistant environment can increase the expression of APOE4. Mm-hmm. And that can then actually lead to what's called the oligers, it has a fancy term, but basically the bonding of different beta amyloid plaques together.
Okay.
And it makes them far harder to clear because there is the opportunity for them to clear. So the more expression of APOE4 is not necessarily what we want, although APOE4 has some other jobs, like we talked about with cholesterol transport, that if somebody is not in a highly inflammatory environment or they are very insulin sensitive, they are not going to have expression as much of those genes. Yeah. But it doesn't mean that they're going to suddenly be able to express the APOE2.
Sure.
They don't have it written in their book of life. They just don't have that gene.
Yeah. Great. Thank you. That's super helpful. Yeah. I think that's a good thing to clarify. I think it's easy for people to get fearful and think, oh my God, this is what my parents are dealing with. That's what I'm going to have to deal with. And they get this defeatist attitude. But like you say, there's so much that we actually can do.
Correct.
To influence this.
And I do have to do a plug for Dale Bredesen, who is a neurologist, a physician who's written extensively on this topic, who's published recent articles, peer-reviewed articles. He wrote a phenomenal book that I know you're going to link in the notes called The End of Alzheimer's. And it is essentially a program for those who have loved ones who have gone through Alzheimer's disease or are at risk of going through Alzheimer's disease, or those who just want to be more proactive in understanding how Alzheimer's disease evolves. And I'm involved in his certification program right now. I haven't yet taken my exam. It's something I'm postponing, but I look forward to being able to get through that. But he does a phenomenal job of really outlining when somebody has a risk, it does not mean that you are going to get this disease. What it does do is you do have to pay attention. You do have to maybe work a little bit harder.
Yeah.
And Jeannie, if you had the E22, perhaps you wouldn't have to work as hard to get your cholesterol low. In fact, guaranteed you wouldn't. But you can't change your genes and we can't influence them. So for you, I may say, oh, probably more plant-based diet is going to be more beneficial than a heavy meat diet in contrast.
Yep.
Yeah.
Good. I love my veggies. So I guess I'm lucky there. Yeah.
Exactly.
Let's talk a little bit about chronic stress and sleep and how these are big. I would guess these would be big influences on this list of things that we can pay more attention to.
Yeah, there is a very clear association between insomnia, specifically chronic insomnia, sleep apnea, and the expression, like we just talked about, of things that are pro-inflammatory. And this isn't just for ApoE carriers, right? If you're listening to this and you're not an ApoE4 or you don't know, you're like,
still applies.
Still applies. REM sleep and non-REM sleep, most people have heard those terms, non-rapid eye movement or rapid eye movement sleep. They both have benefits and we need both of them. And you're in different stages of sleep when you're unconscious. And that is beneficial for clearing out and restoring certain processes in our body, namely metabolic processes. Our blood pressure and even our body temperature are supposed to drop in the middle of the night. Our blood sugar is supposed to drop in the middle of the night. And if we are not getting well-rested sleep, we are not going to have some of those restorative processes. Mm-hmm. There's also more metabolic activity that perks up in the brain during REM sleep. And that can be helpful in some ways. It sounds like, oh, I want my brain to rest, but it also can help clear out some debris, if you will. That's a kind of silly analogy, but there's a lot of benefits to sleep. So we know that, and this is again, not just what I say, but this is over decades of sleep data published, over consistent years of sleep deprivation, under 6.5 hours of sleep a night, definitely under six, we know can lead to chronic disease and has associations with many different chronic diseases. 7.5 seems to be this magic number for adults, most healthy adults. Seems to be just fine. When you start to get above 9, seems to actually be of detriment when we start to oversleep. And if our body is consistently needing that amount of sleep, we want to ask the question, what's going on that I don't feel rested with less than 9 hours of sleep a night?
Yeah, those are great. Thank you. Yeah, I think our whole hustle culture makes that hard for a lot of people. And I think especially when people are stressed, that messes with your sleep and then getting enough sleep and then you're more stressed and it can be this really vicious cycle.
Yes.
And I think tying back into this whole perimenopausal phase, when our hormones are getting wacky, yeah, it can really mess with our sleep. And
yes, it does.
Yeah. I think I talk a lot about sleep hygiene and setting yourself up for success when it comes to a good night's sleep. But as you mentioned before, I think that hormone replacement therapy can sometimes help with that. What are some other ways that people can improve their sleep? Let's say they are doing all the good sleep hygiene and whatnot, but they're still struggling or yeah, waking up at certain times of the night, not being able to fall back to sleep.
Yeah. As a naturopathic physician by training and then functional medicine after, I really lean into botanicals for those who are doing the sleep hygiene, that they're being very intentional about some quiet time before bed, ideally a little bit of a meditation practice. Some people prefer to meditate in the morning, but if they are doing those things and they still are unable to sleep, I think botanicals can be a first line. There's also some very good literature on the benefits of melatonin, particularly microdosing melatonin. Hmm. For my patients, I like to have them at the lowest effective dose possible. It usually helps them fall asleep. Melatonin's not as well known for keeping someone to stay asleep.
Yeah.
And I think that the combination of using cortisol balancing strategies that are, again, both lifestyle derived, not looking at a screen before bed, but particularly finding things that are restorative and calming before bed. Phosphatidylserine is an agent that I use a lot, which is an oral supplement, not a pharmaceutical, and that can also be supportive for cognitive health. There's some small studies associated with cognitive health. It does have a known association to block cortisol, cortisol being the stress hormone that our adrenal glands produce. And if somebody's waking up frequently in the middle of the night or they're not getting good restorative sleep, and sleep disorders like sleep apnea, as an example, have been ruled out, it's important to consider a cortisol dysregulation and using first-line therapies, as I mentioned, to help support that. Botanicals, I'll name a couple that I like. Holy basil is one, magnolia being another, passion flower I really like. Lemon balm, ashwagandha probably being the most famous, but it's not necessarily a sedative. And then pharmaceutically, I think that unfortunately our culture has really driven towards just taking a pill for every ill.
Yeah.
I am not above prescribing sleep support. There's kind of two main ones that I use, hydroxyzine and trazodone if needed. Hydroxyzine over chronic use actually does have some association with cognitive decline. So it's not something I want people using indefinitely. But for periods of time while we're getting their sleep cycle reestablished, it's very effective at sedating somebody enough. And then if it's perimenopausally related, progesterone, there really isn't anything better. Yeah. Although progesterone can also cause some associated water retention and mood symptoms if we dose it too high. So you gotta make sure you're doing that the right way.
Yeah, absolutely. Getting the right support and direction around that from a practitioner that knows what they're doing.
Yes.
So coming back to the weight training piece, because this is huge. And I know for me, I have had sleep challenges off and on throughout my life. And exercise in particular, specifically weight training, has been such a game changer for me. And also as someone with an ADHD diagnosis, when it just, my brain works better all throughout the day. I sleep much better when I am training regularly. And when we're talking about all of the benefits of the things that we can do to age well, I think we have to acknowledge that we're vain creatures. Like, we all want to feel like we look good. So yeah, let's talk a little more about weight training. And I believe for women, we associate increased muscle mass, weight training, especially with men, with increased testosterone. But for women, we actually produce more human growth hormone, correct, when we're doing that, which has anti-aging effects and it's very protective. So talk a little more about that. Obviously, the insulin sensitivity is a huge piece of it. And the more lean muscle mass that we have, the more calories we burn just being alive every day, which is a huge benefit, right?
Yeah. So lean tissue, as we already talked about, highly metabolically active tissue, and the benefits of exercise, we probably couldn't get through an entire day talking about them. But from a, my brain works in a very molecular way. And from that perspective, I think a lot about one of the most important anti-aging hormones, and that is something called, or pathways, I should say, called AMPK. Mm. And AMPK is an anti-aging or longevity pathway. It's one of the things that, if you're familiar with the diabetes drug metformin that's being studied as an anti-aging, anti-cancer drug, AMPK is one of the pathways that activates,
okay.
As does berberine, which is a botanical yeah. that can also activate. So exercise can rev up this pathway as it does many others, and that can then lead to a sequelae of other benefits. And namely, it can really help to support some of that clearing that we talked about at night in the sleep improvement. It can help with insulin sensitivity. It can help reduce the expression of some of those pro-inflammatory genes that then lead to pro-inflammatory proteins, which then can cause deposition and inflammation in different parts of the body,
yeah.
including the brain. And so when we have more lean muscle tissue, yes, we do have a higher expression of certain components that are more growth oriented or anabolic. So there's catabolic breakdown, and then there's anabolic. And so it really does this magical thing, which no pharmaceutical can do, mm-hmm. which is it upregulates the anabolic pathways in the right areas, and it downregulates the ones in the areas we don't want.
Awesome. And I love it.
It just like it does this magic kind of modulation. And that then has these multitude of benefits. And strength training, the reason I hound on my patients about strength training is when you are walking around, there's 24 hours in a day, as we all know. If you do an hour on the treadmill, that is fantastic for your heart in that hour. That is fantastic for your brain. And I am not discouraging anyone from walking if that is your what you like to do. But if you can do half an hour on the treadmill and then half an hour of weights, the benefits that you're going to get the other 23 hours are going to build. And you are then going to have, I think of it as like these little workers that get turned on and they go to work and they're working even when you're not working out. And if you're not doing that on a regular basis, you are, especially if you're over 45, I'm just going to pick that number randomly, you are going to start to lose beneficial lean tissue.
Yeah.
It will happen. Hormones play a role. Stress plays a role. Your body weight, women who are bigger to start with, meaning having more adipose tissue, they tend to just have stronger muscles because they're carrying around more. Women who have leaner frames, even though they may not be as strong as they would like to be, have more muscle tissue. They are more predisposed to things like osteoporosis and risk of falls later, which none of us want to think about when we're in middle age. But it's a thing. We have to think about
Absolutely.
It. Because it can be what we do now influences what happens in 30 years.
Yep.
And it influences what happens in 20 years, in 10 years. So those, they're significant. Yeah.
Yeah. I think that's one of the beautiful things, at least for me, about getting older. And not just recently, but I would say over the last 15 years or so, is that sort of understanding of, or appreciation rather, for how things affect you down the road, and just the appreciation for how quickly time flies. I think if you're a younger woman, you're listening to this, may not seem relevant to you right now, but if you think about how quickly the last year has flown by, it's a flash in the pan. And that seems to accelerate as we get older, right? Each year is a smaller and smaller fraction of our total lifetime. And it does seem to accelerate. And I think about things, I'm like, how is that 10 years ago? It feels like maybe three or four. What? How did this happen?
Yeah.
5, 10, 15, 20 years. Like it can, it's going to fly by before you know it. And when we're young, I remember thinking in my 20s, oh, I'm not going to care what I look like when I'm 50 or something. It seems so far off. It's like, yeah, you are. You're going to care. Yeah. You're going to care just as much, if not more. So just having that kind of foresight, if someone can pick that up and run with it without having to learn it the hard way, it's that if I only knew then what I knew now idea. But hey, we're here to tell you this. Like it's, and even if you are in middle age, like this is the time to start. Or if you're in your 60s, like it's never too late to start and see some of those improvements.
Yeah, we have people. I think one of my nutritionists right now, she's working with someone who I think she's 87 and has never worked with a nutritionist before and is wanting to. And there are things we can do to positively influence even ongoing disease progression. Like, again, not like a complete apostle. Dr. Bredesen also has proven that you can slow and even potentially reverse the signs of cognitive decline in Alzheimer's disease. The earlier you can get somebody on this protocol, the better.
Yeah.
But it's possible. And
exciting.
You know, just the failure that pharmaceuticals have had in the realm of Alzheimer's disease, they have almost unanimously all completely failed to have any significant benefit. They're the ones that have been FDA approved. All they do is slow the decline. Yes. None of them stop or reverse. They just slow the decline, and they are hundreds of thousands of dollars. There have been so much money spent. Mm. I could go on a soapbox.
It's heartbreaking.
But I say that because we are, in our lifetime, Jeannie, you and I, we're going to see that this disease impacts 1 in 5 individuals. That is the projection, is 20%
of I believe it.
The U.S. population will be impacted. And that means we all are going to know someone with this disease. And there are things we can do now. And our clients, our patients can do now, but it's hard. It's hard to see what you're doing now is going to pay dividends in the future. Hindsight's always 20/20. Yeah. So it's just,
it's true. And what I always encourage people to do is just start with one small thing.
Yeah.
Just start with one small thing. Start with the thing that feels most doable for you. If you're not moving at all right now, you're sedentary and you feel like, hey, I could fit in 10 minutes for a walk, or I could do one set of stairs today. Okay, great. Just start there and do it. You can always build on it.
Yeah.
But start with forming a routine around something like that. And then when it feels more second nature, it's a part of your day. Great. Build on it. Or start just paying a little more attention to your diet. Maybe just eat more vegetables.
Yes.
Exactly. Or just less processed food or less sugar or starchy carbs, something low glycemic. Just start there with what you can and then build upon it, because you will feel better and you will see changes over time. But trying to do everything at once and switch everything overnight, I think, is a fool's errand. I think for most people, they're already living demanding lifestyles, and just adding an additional laundry list of demands, it's not going to be sustainable for you. It's just going to feel stressful. And so I think that's always a place to start. And then seek out someone like Dr. Leary, a functional medicine doctor, a naturopathic physician, a nutritionist, someone like me, a nutrition coach that can actually help you maybe do these labs, get some additional information, get some direction and some support around what steps to take, how to change your diet, how to incorporate more exercise in a way that fits into your lifestyle as an individual versus just trying to do all the things that you hear about online, a lot of which is driven by like bro science, and it just gets overwhelming.
Bro science. I like it. No, and the accountability piece too, right? I think that's huge. And I think people, sometimes they get to a point where they get some news that feels like a rude awakening, and they are very motivated to do everything, right? They are very motivated to change their diet and start exercise and maybe initiate a new supplement and, if needed, medication program. I have those patients in my practice, and I often talk to them about sustainability, because we have to, I think when they get a jump start and they start to see the weight come off, or they start to, here I am using the term weight, they start to see changes in their bodies metabolically, and they start to notice, wow, like I'm feeling a lot better and I'm waking up feeling more rested. You get buy-in and then you got to figure out what's sustainable because you can't, the yo-yo thing is just, it's going to put you right back to where you were, perhaps in a little bit of a better spot than if you had just continued to go on that trajectory. So
yeah, exactly. And often doing all the things all at once isn't possible when your routine gets thrown off, when you go on vacation or suddenly you have to fly someplace and for work or you have a family emergency or something like that. There needs to be a way to anchor into some basics, some foundational practices that can carry you through those volatile times because that's life, right? It's not going to be predictable.
Yes, exactly. So, yeah. You mentioned labs. Did you want to go over some just examples of labs that people can ask for, consider?
I would love that. If you can touch on basic things that people would ask for that they're, because I think sometimes it can be challenging if people are in the insurance system seeing a regular MD and they aren't necessarily, they don't know how to advocate for themselves. They don't know what to ask for. Sometimes they'll get pushback from those doctors. Sometimes things aren't covered by insurance, so it gets really expensive. But what are there a few things, Dr. Leary, that people can ask for that it's likely they'll be able to get, insurance may cover it, a good starting place?
Yes. So there are things, if you can get your, if you are listening to this and you don't have access to a functional medicine provider or someone who has access to labs that are more comprehensive, trying to at least get a fasting insulin level and a hemoglobin A1C are not labs that are difficult nor expensive. If your provider is not ordering an advanced lipid panel, which is also known as an NMR panel, cholesterol, asking for at least an ApoB test. ApoB is one of the markers. You can do a standard lipid panel, and ApoB, I think from a routine lab, is around $12 if it's not covered by insurance. Mm-hmm. It is not an expensive test, relatively speaking. Comprehensive thyroid labs are advised. And then if somebody is in the perimenopausal or unsure, I think hormones can be very valuable. Traditionally, even OBGYNs often will not test for hormones. Yeah. I do think it's valuable to know where one's hormones are, even if they're not cycling anymore, only because we talked about that fat production of estrogen and conversion and getting a sense of where they are starting place. Blood is not perfect, but in any case, hormones are valuable. Inflammatory markers, something called hsCRP, which is a high sensitivity C-reactive protein. Ferritin is iron status, but it also can be an inflammatory marker. Looking at your white blood cell count, which is called a CBC. And then always looking for if there is any ongoing autoimmune process. There is a test called an ANA, which has a lot of false positives. Sometimes docs won't order it specifically for that, but I do find that ANAs can be useful and they're widely accessible. And then heavy metals are something that I never used to test. And I think I didn't test for it because I frankly didn't know what to do with it if they were positive. And I wasn't prepared to do chelation with my patients. I now screen for heavy metals in blood, which is, again, urine is probably better, but it's very inexpensive to do in blood. Okay. If somebody has a high heavy metal, lead, mercury, cadmium, arsenic, that is creating an inflammatory and something called oxidative stress response. Yep. Their body is being assaulted. Every single day, there is no safe level of mercury. And remember, when you and I were young, we were getting mercury amalgams put in.
Yeah.
I mean, that was standard of care in dentistry.
Right.
So even if you're being very careful about your diet and you don't live in an area where there's a lot of risk for contamination, healthy chocolate can contain quite a bit of cadmium. It's where it's produced in the pollution or where it's harvested, I should say. 100% cacao from the rainforest. Guess what? When they test it. So these are areas that you want to look for. The fancier tests, stool analyses, and certainly we talked about urine for hormones, potentially urine for heavy metals. Those are great if you can get them, but not everybody has access. And I will do one plug if I can for functionhealth.com. Jeannie, do you know about them?
I do, yeah. This is Dr. Hyman's new company,
correct?
Yes,
Dr. Hyman is one of the owners of Function Health, but it is a really good company. I, full disclosure, do some consulting and writing for them. So I'm biased here, but just so everybody knows, I have a little skin in the game. But I do really like them for those who want to directly order their own labs. It's a very comprehensive panel. It's over 100 lab tests, many of which you are going to get something that's actionable. The challenge is if you don't have access, again, to a functional medicine provider to then help you walk through the interpretation of that. Function Health does give you an interpretation guide. I think it's still beneficial. My humble opinion is still beneficial to have a provider to help support you, but it's better than not knowing, because you can find, there are resources online. There are podcasts. You can take it into your own hands. And then The End of Alzheimer's book by Dale Bredesen. Again, I can't say enough about the empowerment that people feel when they read that, even if they're an APOE4/4, right? Yeah, so that's something that's really important. And then, I'm sorry, I know I'm dragging on here, but Epstein-Barr, you and I did not talk about this. It's a big one for cognitive health. It's a big one for inflammatory stimuli. If somebody has a reactivated Epstein-Barr virus infection, and particularly if something called their early antigen or their IgM Epstein-Barr titer, which is an antibody, is elevated, those do strongly correlate with an activated infection. And it's in the herpes virus family. Mm-hmm. So if somebody has cold sores or a history of herpes viruses, those are also very pro-inflammatory stimuli, and viral suppression therapy is really important to talk to their provider about. I probably didn't emphasize that enough.
Yeah. Lastly, because I know we're out of time here, so I want to be respectful of your time. We need to wrap up. This has been so fascinating. But as far as foods, I know I have a handful of go-to brain healthy, brain supportive foods that I always recommend. Obviously, more vegetables, try to eat the rainbow, avoid those processed foods, sugar, increase your cold water fish, like high omega 3 things, walnuts, chia. Anything else that I didn't mention there that you recommend as far as more foods to incorporate or your favorites to avoid?
I'm just a big fan of kind of a leaning towards a Mediterranean keto. Mediterranean type diet without the grains. And I do the acronym SMASH fish, wild caught only. SMASH stands for salmon, mackerel, anchovies, sardines, and herring. Those are the five fish that have the lowest level of toxicity to them. Our oceans are unfortunately becoming increasingly polluted. But wild caught always. I think you covered most of them. Dark berries, artichokes, wheat germ, I think is another good thing to easily add in. Fiber, chia seeds. Fiber, can't say enough about the importance of fiber for the digestive tract. Yeah, I think those are the big ones.
Great. Cool. Anything else you want to leave people with before we sign off today? This is a lot of great information.
Yeah, just knowing your APOE status, I think. If you have a good reason for not knowing, such as you are concerned about life insurance coverage, or you just frankly know it'll enhance your anxiety, maybe those are good reasons to not know. But in my practice, I think knowledge is power. And I think there's a lot we can do. And a quarter of the population, 25% of the U.S. population, has at least one copy of the APOE4, and less than 1% of people know it. I think if we can, as a community, come together and realize how many people this is going to affect, and we can really make some sustainable changes, but without knowing, there's less motivation, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, agreed. Absolutely. Thank you so much for joining us today for this great information, sharing all of your knowledge and wonderful heart for your patients. I just really appreciate you being here. And we'll do it
Thank
again.
Thank you for having me. Thanks for dealing with my voice.
No problem. Okay. We'll see you next time. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hey there, thanks for hanging out with me today. And if you enjoyed the show, please subscribe and leave me a quick review. Also, check out the show notes for links to connect, follow, and share this podcast, and for information featured in each episode. See you next time. I am not a doctor, and the content here should not be taken as medical advice. All information in this podcast is for informational purposes only, does not constitute medical advice, and does not establish any kind of practitioner or coach-client relationship. This podcast is not a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Do not disregard medical advice or delay seeking medical advice because of information you hear in this podcast or any other, and do not start or stop any medications without speaking to your health provider. Always seek the advice of a qualified health practitioner before undertaking a new health regimen. This podcast and website represents the opinion of Jeannie Oliver and guests to the show. Opinions of guests are their own and do not reflect the opinions of Jeannie Oliver Wellness LLC or our producers.